Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. We're also very happy to have back on the program now for the first time in year, 2009, May Barenbaum. She is head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I and is a scientist who specializes in studying insects. And over the years, many times, she's been on the program. And we've said to people, well, if you have insect-related questions, you're welcome to call. Where we draw the line is with extermination issues. We got a guy for that, Phil Nixon. He's an extension entomologist and helps people with dealing with pest problems. And I'm sure sometime here in the spring, pretty soon, we'll have him on. And if you have a bug problem and you want to get rid of it, he's the guy. When May is here on the program, we do something different. And we say, well, you know, insects are actually pretty cool and pretty interesting and sometimes very strange and sometimes all of the above. And we say, well, when she's here, if you have other kinds of questions about insects, how they live their lives and what they are up to, then we take those questions. And around this time of the year, we ask her to come and be on the program so that she can talk about the Insect Fear Film Festival. Now, it's 26 years?
This is year 26.
Year 26. Been going on now for a long, long time. Has achieved international fame. She started it a long time ago, both, I think, to have some fun and recognizing that it might be a teachable moment when it came to insects. So the festival is coming up on Saturday. We'll talk about that and other insect-related questions. They are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Tell the story again about how this whole thing got started, that you decided, well, maybe that would be fun to do this.
Well, the idea for the Insect Fear Film Festival actually occurred to me when I was in graduate school at Cornell and in entomology, and was walking on campus and saw that the Asian Student Association was having a film festival featuring Godzilla. And I thought, well, if the Asian students can have a sense of humor about who they are, then why can't entomologists? So we could do an insect fear film festival and show people why what they're about to see can't possibly happen and use it as a teachable moment. And I went to the head of the department there, and he thought that would be just way too undignified and that maybe we could show some insect documentaries, which wasn't the point at all. So I kind of shelved the idea, and then I got a job here and worked for a couple of years to kind of establish my credentials as a solid scientist, and then went to the department head and pitched the idea. And he not only thought it was a great idea, he thought we should charge admission and get a teaching assistantship out of it. But again, we didn't want people to pay to see this some of Hollywood's worst efforts. So it's entirely free. We get supported every year from SORF, the student organization on campus, and the official sponsors of the Insect Fear Film Festival is our Entomology Graduate Student Association. So, the first festival was in 1984, and I didn't actually know anything about running a film festival. So I wrote a letter when I was in the planning stages to the director of the Unit for Cinema Studies, suggesting maybe that we could co-sponsor the festival. And the director gave the letter to his assistant director because he was busy and didn't want to be bothered by this odd request. So the assistant director wrote a really nice note back saying they were very busy that year with French and German retrospectives, but he'd be happy to help with the planning. And long story short, that assistant director, who's now the director of cinema studies, I ended up marrying 5 years later. And as I like to point out to him, the Insect Fear Film Festival has consistently drawn much larger crowds than any French or German retrospective they've ever had. So.
I'm certain. So this all worked pretty well for all concerned. You managed to find yourself a guy and have a lovely daughter. And all of this
was because
of the film festival.
Of my desire to showcase the real biology of the class insecta.
All right. Well, it's coming up this weekend. It's free, open to anybody who is interested in attending. And as usual, have some features and some shorts and insect petting zoo.
Yeah. This year, we have lately been organizing around theme. Lately, by lately, I mean the last decade. And this year's theme is centipede cinema. Those astute members of the listening audience will quickly realize that centipedes are not in fact, insects. They belong to a class. They're in a class by themselves, literally. They're in the class Chilopoda. They're not even in the same class as the millipedes. The millipedes are sufficiently different from centipedes that they're in their own class, the Diplopoda, although they're lumped together in a what entomologists call a superclass, the Myriapoda, myria meaning many, myriad. So technically, how can we have an insect fear film festival with movies about centipedes? And the reason we can is that most of the entomologists in these movies seem to think that they're insects. So and you could also argue that because centipedes are predators, they a large part of the diet of most centipedes is insects. So insects would be fearful of centipedes. So an insect fear film might be an object of fear from the insect perspective. Millipedes, however, do not feed. They're more or less, they feed on decaying plant material. And they're actually cute. They're not really scary. Centipedes, though, no petting zoo for centipedes because their technical name, the Chilopoda, Chilo, they have these poison jaws. That's what the Chilo part means. And they are venomous and they can bite you. And the big ones, the biggest, very biggest, can be more than a foot in length, will eat bats and reptiles and other vertebrates. So, yeah, so you can look but don't touch.
I guess I'm not exactly sure how you could consider one cute and the other not. But, you know, maybe that's an acquired sort of an appreciation.
Well, if you'd like to see how cute millipedes are, look at the Sunday News Gazette at the article Rob Cantor wrote about our festival. And the photograph is actually labeled centipede, and it is a millipede. Any entomologist would know instantly that.
And who was responsible?
Endearing little arthropod is not a centipede. I don't really know, but the grad student who provided the photo swore it was that he had identified it as a millipede, and that's good because I told him if it had been him, it would be the first question on his prelims this year. So.
I think that would cause some problems there. Well, anyway, so that's a little bit about the festival. We have a couple of people here who have questions. We'd like to give them a chance to talk with May. And again, the festival's coming up this weekend, Saturday. Is it at Follinger? They always have been at Follinger?
Not time? Always. We actually started out small. We were in 228 Natural History Building, and then we moved to Lincoln, and then we moved into Follinger. So we've been there for a long time.
Okay, and suitable for family viewing this time around?
That's actually a good point. As usual, we'll start with family-friendly shorts. We have two Disney shorts, and they feature the same centipede gag. Every time a centipede is in a cartoon, all his body segments will run off in one direction and then reassemble. So you'll see that gag in Woodland Cafe and then Mickey's Garden. Then we have a couple of other shorts. We have a Watch Mr. Wizard show from 1954 on animal locomotion. And you can see how far children's educational broadcasting has come in the last half century. And then we'll start with a feature called Centipede, which was on the Sci-Fi Channel, which is just sort of inept. But our late night feature, the second feature, is called Centipede Horror. And that is definitely not for the weak of stomach. And Sam Raimi is a famous director who did Evil Dead. He's known for his gore fests. Mm-hmm. He said this was the most disgusting movie he's ever seen.
So. Oof. If he thinks it's disgusting.
It's disgusting.
It's disgusting.
And,
all right.
Yeah, very surreal. So that's not family friendly. But the first, as usual, the first hour will be.
All right. Very good. Well, our guest this morning is May Barenbaum. She's head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I. Insect questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And we'll start by talking with someone in Mahomet, and this is line number one. Hello.
Yes. I would like to ask you, I heard on the BBC that the EU is banning herbicides and insecticides for farmers in Europe because they said they're dangerous to their health. Do you know anything about that?
About human health or
I know that, human health. Yeah.
Well, some of the concerns arise from the fact that these herbicides and fungicides can act as synergists, or they can interact with other foreign substances, including pesticides, to enhance their toxicity. I don't know which specific herbicides are on the list for bans, but I know there's been a lot of discussion on blogs and other listservs about the strength of evidence of human, you know, non-target human effects. I do know a little bit more about bans on a specific group of pesticides called the neonicotinoids that have been implicated in these bee disappearances. This is a group of neurotoxic insecticides that have been implicated in there's some laboratory studies that show that they have impacts on honeybee learning and memory. So it's thought that they may be contributing to this, you know, colony collapse disorder where the bees simply fail to return to the hive. And France banned them actually about almost 10 years ago, particularly in sunflower, which is a bee-pollinated crop plant that's of considerable importance throughout Europe.
Right. I've heard about that. Are American authorities looking into this or just the EU?
American authorities are looking into it. And in fact, there's not a lot of compelling evidence that the principle that there's a logical progression that would suggest that the neonicotinoids are contributing to pollinator problems because, among other things, they're everywhere. They're used prophylactically and seed treatments and the like. They're systemic, which means when you apply them to the plant takes them up into its system, its vascular system, and these insecticides end up in the nectar and the pollen, which you would think would lead to increased exposure of pollinators.
Yeah, it sounds kind of scary, really. I mean, to ban them from farmers using them, and you would presume that the EU would have some pretty substantial evidence to ban them.
Yeah, I apologize for not being more up on the ban. I know there's been a lot of concern, and it was my impression that the ban is not a blanket ban. It's targeted for particular crops and crop systems. Is that right? Do you remember reading that?
They didn't say specifically. They just said they were going to ban these herbicides and insecticides and pesticides from farmers using them on their plants because they were dangerous to your health. And then they didn't go on and explain in any way, but it sounded pretty scary to me.
Yeah, it's people sometimes, you know, there's always nothing is black and white, particularly when, as far as agriculture is concerned. People argue that there should be no non-target effects, but in reality, when you put a shovel in the dirt and turn the soil over, you're having an ecological impact. There's no way to farm without affecting natural systems. It's a simple fact of life, and it's been going on for some 10,000 years. So there are trade-offs between different kinds of risks. For example, corn, you know, corn earworms are a problem, and sweet corn in particular. They damage the corn, as the name suggests. They feed on the a whole range of types of fruits. They also, in the course of causing damage, leave the plants vulnerable to colonization by naturally occurring molds and fungi, including Aspergillus species, which produce aflatoxins, which are far more carcinogenic than any of the pesticides that are used to control the corn earworm. So I'm not advocating spraying or not spraying. It's just that it's a jungle out there. There are all kinds of risks.
They also have banned genetically altered foods over there in the EU, which were dumped on our market without ever asking us anything about it. And again, you know, I don't think in the U.S. that we understand that. I mean, I don't know about genetically altered foods, but certainly I don't think they would have banned them or refused to take them if they hadn't had real concerns about them.
Well, again, it's really interesting to see public reactions because, in fact, the genetically modified crops were introduced as a more ecologically sustainable alternative to synthetic chemical pesticides. People forget that. And in fact, they are. It's not like anyone is flying over crop fields and spraying acres and acres. These are very targeted toxins, and yes, there are some non-target effects. But again, you cannot farm without affecting the environment. That's just you just can't do it. So, the most recent example of of a puzzling reaction on the part of the public involves the light brown apple moth. This is a newly discovered, introduced pest in California. This is a crop that's native to Australia, and in Australia it has a couple of hundred host plants. Among the plants on which it can cause damage are citrus, which is a huge crop in California, and grapes, which is also another huge crop in California. So the California Department of Food and Agriculture decided to be environmentally responsible and sustainable by spraying a synthetic pheromone. This is an analog of the chemical that is produced by female moths to attract male moths, and it has no known non-target impacts even on other members of the same moth family. But there was a massive protest, and spraying was halted because people were concerned about human non-target human health impacts. Yeah. Even though there's no suggestion that there are any, they're claiming that the micro capsules in which these components are encapsulated haven't really been investigated thoroughly. But it's funny because the original thought of the Department of Food and Agriculture was that this was an environmentally responsible way to respond. But, you know, we don't really know what's going on in the environment. So.
Well, there was this farmer on from Indiana, and he said that Monsanto came in and tried to force all the farmers to use genetically altered materials. And he said he fought him in court for a couple of years, but he said that the strong-arm tactics that they were using were just unconscionable, and he refused to do it. And this was genetically altered, which he says now are being used everywhere simply because farmers like them because they don't take any care. And he said he refused to do it. You know, and again, this was a real concern to me to think that a farmer would fight them in court for 2 years. And he said Monsanto's all over the place, and they come in and they tell you they want to see all your books and they want to see what you're using. And if you're using any of their products, they want to sue you. And he said, and I don't want to use any of their products, but he said what's going on in this country is just unconscionable. And he said nobody seems to know about it. Do you know anything about that?
Well, actually, I've read about that particular case, but I really—that's kind of outside. I'm an insect person.
Yeah,
so.
I sort of feel like—I mean, I appreciate the caller's questions, and I'm sure that we could have some discussion on that on the program. It's just that this is like way outside of the territory we staked out for the show, and also I think May would say, even though it's something that she's really well informed about, is also outside of her area of work. So I hope the caller will forgive me. I'm going to jump in and say, you know, we need to kind of get back on track here. And maybe this particular subject is something that we should talk about on the program. And I'm sure that there are people here at the university who would be happy to do it.
Particularly the legal aspects about which I know next to nothing.
Okay. So. May Barenbaum is our guest. She's head of the Department of Entomology. She's a scientist who specializes in studying insects. And that's kind of what we're talking about here this morning. In part, we asked her to come on the program to give us a little preview of the Insect Fear Film Festival coming up this weekend. But, of course, if people have insect-related questions, she, I think, will do her best to give you an answer. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Atlanta is next. I think that's Atlanta, Illinois, not Atlanta, Georgia. Line number four. Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Yes.
I live in a grassy, wooded area, and I've got a question about a insect that I'm surely would deserve a film made about it. It's ticks. Sometime as going out mushroom hunting or something, I might come back with 20 or 30 dog ticks on me, so that just shows you the amount that are in this area. My question is, environmentally, ecologically, what good are ticks?
That's a really interesting question. Actually, ticks are not insects. They're arachnids. They're more closely related to spiders. Actually, their very closest relatives are mites. All ticks are parasites, ectoparasites. Some mites are also parasitic mites, but mites do a whole lot more different things. Ticks all are bloodsuckers. That's what they're good at. And in terms of what they're good for, I have to say I'm on the board of directors for the Xerxes Society for the Preservation of Endangered Invertebrates, and the hardest sell for conserving endangered species is ticks and endangered species of ticks, because a lot of ticks are quite generalized. They'll attack just about anything that's breathing and reasonably warm-blooded, like the dog tick that you mentioned. And clearly, they're not restricted to just dogs. Whatever they can catch, they'll feed on. But there are some ticks that are quite host-specific, and there's a white rhino tick, actually, and the white rhino is terribly endangered, as is the white rhino tick. Who cares, you say? Nobody is crying to save the white rhino tick, because the perception, they're not really good for anything. And it is hard to come up with an explanation as to where they fit in various and sundry food webs. But I could argue for those pathogens, those disease-causing organisms that need ticks to go from host to host, that's an important partnership from their perspective. Of course, Lyme disease is a tick-borne disease, human disease, and it's spread by Ixodes damini, which is the deer tick, and without Ixodes scapularis, they changed the name. Without Ixodes, there would be no Lyme disease, no pathogen. Borrelia burgdorferi could not get from host to host. So I'm sure if spirochetes ran the world, ticks would be the heroes. There are also a few organisms that eat ticks. The oxpeckers in Africa, in fact, are themselves experiencing a decline in numbers. These are the birds that hop along the backs of large mammals and pick off their ticks and other ectoparasites and eat them. So, again, to save the oxpeckers, we may have to save the ticks on the endangered white rhinos. So maybe that's not a compelling argument in and of itself, but there are organisms that appreciate ticks.
So in central Illinois, though, we could possibly
live without them.
Ecology, we could probably maybe do without them. Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, there are grander arguments one could make about the regulation of populations. You know, they can cause mortality in various small mammals and the like. But yeah, in general, I think we could probably do all right without them.
In this case here, the other thing that we're overrun with because of the ecology here is mice. Will they kill mice? Do they attack mice?
Well, there's a partnership there. The white-footed mouse, there are two species of Paramiscus. They're important hosts for the deer tick. The deer tick is a three-host ectoparasite. So it feeds three times. It needs three different hosts to feed on. The adult ticks live on deer, hence the name deer tick. But the immature stages, the littlest ticks, feed on those white-footed mice and their relatives. So they're an important part of the tick's life. So they'd probably be happy without them too, but the ticks kind of need the mice. So.
Well, that's another reason. They're probably, matter of fact, I have had Lyme's disease, so that is... Yeah. You know, it is a strong possibility out here that there are also deer ticks, which are a little harder to pick off because you can't see them as easily. But
one of the treatments, one of the ways, it's really kind of, as you might suppose, it's hard to treat an entire wooded ecosystem to try to eliminate deer ticks. One of the more successful approaches that have been used is to put out pesticide impregnated cotton. Like pyrethroid impregnated cotton. Why does that work? Because the mice look for bedding materials, and they love the cotton, and they bring it back to their little nests and burrows. And actually, the pesticide impregnated cotton reduces their ectoparasite load, which basically interferes with the transmission of the Lyme disease pathogen. So.
Very interesting. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. We are here this morning, about midway through this hour of Focus 580, with May Barenbaum. She's head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I. She's a scientist who specializes in studying insects. And every once in a while, he's here on the program, and we have a little insect talk. And in part, at this time of the year, she's here, and we talk about the Insect Fear Film Festival. It's coming up on Saturday. It's free and open to the public. Anyone who wants to attend should feel welcome. It's at least partly family friendly. Later on, it gets creepy. So the little kids, you don't want them for that. But there's something here for everybody. And it's been going on now for 26 years, right, on the campus.
And a new feature, we'll have our T-shirts as usual. This one features a magnificent centipede. But we're also going to be having our centennial calendars. This is the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Department of Entomology at the University of Illinois. We thought a good way to commemorate our 100th birthday would be to come out with a calendar featuring Illini insects. So we have 12 months of orange and blue insects.
Orange and blue insects. And it's very nice, suitable for gift giving or framing or just hanging on the wall. It's
and there really, are important nice. Dates in entomological history that are highlighted along with other kind of more traditional.
More stuff to amaze your friends with. Very good. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Champagne is our next caller. Line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
What news these days of our friends, the buzzy bees, hive collapse disorder, all that kind of stuff? What do you know about that? And also, what do you know about what happened to the, oh, there were some very aggressive African bees mm-hmm. or something like that that were making their way north, and whatever happened with them, they've seemed to have dropped out of the news. And lastly, where do you get your material for the film? Because the only major film that comes to mind that, of course, I would hardly claim to be an expert of the genre, is Them, which recently James Whitmore died, and so on and so forth. But, where do you find your material? Because I've never noticed that insects were big parts of scary movies and so on and so forth, and at least at the level of a movie like Them and so forth. And well, like that. Tell us about the bees, anyway. I want to know most about the buzzers. I want to see some buzzy bees around here, and I'm hoping they're coming. Thank you.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you. Three questions. So bees, as it turns out, I'm actually going to the USDA Agricultural Outlook meeting later this week, where that's an item on the agenda. There was a meeting in Florida just the first week of February of beekeepers, bee biologists, you know, researchers and the like to kind of assess – Apiary Inspectors of America had their meeting there to kind of assess the landscape. And it appears that even though there's still no definitively established cause for this phenomenon of colony collapse disorder. As Kim Flottam, who edits the Bee Culture magazine, put it, more has been learned about bees in the last 2 years than in the previous 20 because the research effort has been ramped up. And what has been discovered over the past 2 years in the course of attempting to identify what the causative agent is, that pesticide residues, in-hive residues, are everywhere. It's kind of actually jaw-dropping. In the 1980s, the parasitic mite was introduced accidentally into the U.S. called the Varroa mite, or sometimes called the vampire mite, and it sucks the blood of bees, particularly when they're in their pupal stage. They're, you know, metamorphosing from larva to adult, and they can't really defend themselves. And an infestation of varroa can bring a colony down quite quickly. And as a consequence, beekeepers have been using two different insecticides, one called fluvalinate and one called Cumafos, to control mites. And it's a really tricky thing to control mites on insects because mites are arthropods. Insects are arthropods. Anything that kills one arthropod is likely to kill another. So it's a fine line between toxic and therapeutic. And what's been discovered, some of the work done right here at University of Illinois, is that, a survey of chemical residues done by Penn State entomologists showed that 100% of the colonies surveyed had contaminant residues of both of those pesticides. And what was discovered here, actually by a graduate student in our department, Reed Johnson, is those two insecticides synergize each other. One makes the other more toxic. So basically, by recycling the wax foundation that's used for frames and honeybee hives, beekeepers may have inadvertently been poisoning bees or introducing relatively high levels, potentially life-threatening levels of poison. So now, in response to this, these findings, beekeepers are using brand new foundation. They're not recycling. They're, you know, sort of cleaning up the internal environment of the hive. So that was a big finding. They're also finding that, well, it's long been known that bees are incredibly susceptible to all kinds of pathogens. They found a new pathogen, Israeli acute paralysis virus. They found a new fungal disease. But what they're also finding, much to everyone's shock and dismay, is that some of these viral pathogens may actually be transmissible through pollen, that they are contaminating residues are left by visiting pollinators so that subsequent visitors to those flowers can actually acquire viral diseases that way. This was not a mechanism of transmission anyone ever thought was possible. So it is a dangerous world out there if you're a bee. In terms of the years of the health and welfare of America's bees, it seems that colony numbers are recovering. It's a little hard to say because the numbers change throughout the year. And this is a critical time. The month of February is when half of all of America's bees, 1.25 million colonies of honeybees, travel to California to pollinate the almond crop. And every almond that is produced is the result of the activity of a honeybee. You cannot grow almonds here without renting bees and using the bees to pollinate them. So there's such a huge thing. I think it's 600,000 acres of almonds are planted in California. It's a $2.5 billion crop, and they rent half of America's bees to get that done. So there are some losses starting to be reported in these California orchards, but we won't really know for another couple weeks whether or not this phenomenon is still afflicting bees. So that was the bee question. The movie question is easy to answer. There's no shortage of bad insect-fear films.
You would know that now, having become an expert in this field. I was sitting there thinking when he was saying the only movie he could think of was Them, which involves giant ants. I'm thinking, well, this guy's not looking because there actually are lots and lots. And maybe I only know that because I know you and we've talked about this over the years.
No, we've actually, I think, only repeated films twice. One was deliberate because we were it was one of our it was an ant festival, and we showed Them at our first festival in 84. But how could you not show Them again? And then we repeated Beginning of the End at our 20th festival because we showed that at our first festival as well. That was Giant Grasshoppers Attack Central Illinois. We had to show that because our 20th festival, we invited Bert I. Gordon, the 83-year-old director of that film. So that was one of his his magnum opus. So this is famous among insect fear film enthusiasts because of its setting. These grasshoppers are produced by radiation experiments in the USDA lab in Rantoul. These giant grasshoppers are slowly making their way to Chicago against a backdrop of mountains. And there's one of my favorite lines is, "They've reached the suburbs of Paxton." Yeah. That was great. So, and then there was a third question.
You want to know about the killer bees.
Oh, yes, Africanized bees. They're certainly in the news. If you go to Google News and type in honeybees, they've just been reported in Utah, which is a concern. They're advancing northward, which is a concern, although it's a mixed blessing because, yes, they're more aggressive. They're much harder to manage. They are more likely to run into people and cause sort of unpleasantness in that respect. But they also seem to be somewhat resistant to whatever this mysterious colony collapse disorder is. So Africanized colonies where the African genes have sort of taken over, seem to be less likely to collapse. So I guess every cloud has a silver lining.
Okay. I think that's all the questions. And let's talk again with somebody else here now. We have somebody on line one. Hello.
Hello. Is that my line?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I had two little questions there, but listening, I've got a third question, which is actually better. I don't think we should blame the manufacturers of these insecticides that this synergism occurred. Although it would be very nice if they somehow would have figured that out. My question is, who out there would be your best understanding of who should have been doing a study maybe to see if something like that was going to happen? And, of course, I think the legitimacy of my question goes to the fact that, as you've said, the bee population is incredibly necessary for most of our non-meat food chain.
So that's an interesting issue as to, and it's trickier than you might think. Whose responsibility is it to anticipate non-target impacts? And that's really tough because, among other things, the bees are not like other insects because they're social species, and the way standard bees are part of screening of just about every pesticide now, because they are. pollinators. They're a necessary component in growing some 90 crops in the U.S. There are actually there's a whole long series of lawsuits about beekeepers suing farmers who apply pesticides and drift causes losses. According to the law, bees are considered business guests in agricultural fields. So that's the legal view. But the thing is about bees is that they once you open up a colony, they can go anywhere, and there's it's very difficult to predict what environments they'll be visiting and what they'll encounter when they visit.
Right.
So,
who do you think maybe would be the best people that could have been thinking, oh, gee, maybe we ought to check into that?
Well, it's the Environmental Protection Agency's responsibility, and it's not for want of effort. There are assays that have been developed to determine so-called LD50, lethal dose 50, of pesticides for beneficials, so not just bees.
Now, my dear lady, is the Environmental Protection Agency staffed with science-oriented people who contemplate these kinds of things, or is it staffed with lawyers and bureaucrats?
Well, there's scientists in the EPA.
Oh, that's good news.
And it's also it is far more difficult than you might imagine to devise a standardized test for there's a countless number of non-target species. We don't even know what's out there. And we also don't know.
Probably getting short on time here, so let me get to my other two questions quickly. Is there anybody or any sector of our science area that's working on genetics so that maybe we could simply eradicate the ticks? Anybody working on that kind of genetics?
As a matter of fact, the tick genome is currently being sequenced. That effort is being led by Purdue University, and it's an Ixodes that's being the same genus as the deer. In fact, it is the deer tick that's being sequenced. So once the complete genome is known, we'll have all kinds of potential new approaches to manage ticks.
My last question, therefore, is other than that bird that seems to have designed itself to eat ticks, is there any other species that we know of that's going to perhaps die out if we get rid of all the ticks?
Well, all the ticks, that's a hard one because there are...
Almost. Whatever. You get the idea.
Yeah. The law of unintended consequences, if the ticks suddenly dropped out, ticks are important in regulating populations of all kinds. Parasites in general are density-dependent mortality factors that contribute to regulating population sizes of all kinds of organisms. So if you remove one of the brakes on population growth of any particular organism, all kinds of other imbalances may result. So, again, it's hard to predict what happens if, for example, deer ticks may be contributing to mortality of white-footed mice. What happens if that mortality source is removed? White-footed mice could increase in numbers. They could one could spin all kinds of scenarios. It's hard to – I think Paul Ehrlich, who is an ecologist of some renown, put this issue in a nice place by saying people argue we don't need every species. Well, one could argue an airplane doesn't need every rivet either. You could pop a few rivets, but the thing is we don't know how many rivets we can afford to lose before the plane comes down. So at least the plane is engineered and people know what the function of each rivet's supposed to be. We don't know. You don't even know who's out there in most ecosystems, much less what they're contributing to maintaining.
All right. We have about – I want to thank the caller. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is May Barenbaum. She's head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I. She's a scientist who specializes in studying insects, and every once in a while is here, and that's what we talk about. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And next, someone in, I think, Farina, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a corollary for your film festival, the insect love movies. I just saw the bee movie recently, the one with Jerry Seinfeld's voice. It's just a great little movie. The bee, The bee sues the human race for taking its honey. Have you seen this movie?
We featured it last year at our 25th festival, and we actually got Simon Smith, the director, to come all the way out here.
Oh.
We did a Q&A. He was just brilliant. That's one of my favorite movies.
It's so good. It's so funny.
Yeah, it is funny.
And then, of course, the Ant movie and the Bugs Life movie, and there's a Saturday morning cartoon and everything. So you could have your... Insect Love Festival or something, but have you heard anything about the monarch butterflies suffering ill effects from the GMO corn? Not to belabor that topic again, but I've heard this, that the monarch butterflies are die when they, or there's a suspicion that they're dying from the GMO corn. And that's all I'll ask right now. Thanks.
Okay.
Actually, a somewhat long story. 1999, a paper came out in Nature. It was a laboratory study with only 44 caterpillars demonstrating, in fact, that were caterpillars to eat GM corn pollen, they would suffer ill effects. That's what it's designed to do, is to kill Lepidoptera, butterfly caterpillars and moth caterpillars. And we here at University of Illinois actually conducted some studies under field conditions to determine if caterpillars do not normally eat pollen. So it would be an unusual set of circumstances that would expose caterpillars to sufficient numbers of pollen grains to cause a risk. And in fact, as it turns out, the GMO variant that's planted extensively in central Illinois and elsewhere in the country is not particularly toxic to the monarch, and they are unlikely to eat large quantities of pollen. So the risk is substantially less than, for example, automobile grills when you drive across the country while they're migrating, kill way more monarchs. Multicolored Asian lady beetle, which is a biocontrol agent that was introduced to control aphids, ends up eating monarch caterpillars. So in the panoply of mortality factors that influence monarch populations, GM corn is very difficult to demonstrate as having any adverse impact. Yet this is an idea that took hold in the popular psyche. And there are lots of things wrong with GM corn, but concern for the monarch caterpillar shouldn't be one of them.
All right. And let's see. Let's go next to line number two. And this is Charleston. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
Hi. I just started listening about 25 minutes ago, so I'm sorry if this question's already come up. But I've heard that it's impossible to find or label any honey as organic. However, is there isolated fields within like a 30,000 radius in like India? I've seen a commercial Mahavishnu organic honey. Is that even possible with all of these GMOs and pesticides?
Well, that's an interesting question. There are other aspects of people do sell organic honey, and the at issue is you can't control where the bees go, so you don't know if they're going to any places where there's been chemical spray or GM crops. But there are organic approaches to maintaining honeybee, using small cell foundation, for example, and not using in-hive miticides. So there is sort of organic-friendly honey that is produced right here in the U.S., but there's really no guarantees. And in fact, there's a kind of recent scandal on honey laundering, not money laundering, but honey laundering. The Chinese have been, their honey has been found to be contaminated with antibiotics, with corn syrup, with all kinds of other adulterants. And there are limits to what can be imported, but apparently shipments of honey are being routed through Brazil and other honey producing countries that are actually Chinese. So look for the Made in USA label if you don't want antibiotics in your honey. So that's
sure,
an issue. Sure.
All right. On to another caller. This is someone listening in. Arthur, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I got two comments. Somebody just barely said something about GMO corn. If we didn't have GMO corn, we would have to use thousands, and this is nationwide, thousands of tons of very toxic insecticides to control things. So GMO corn stops thousands of tons of that. And the second comment is we saw a very interesting documentary on the monarch butterfly and how it migrates in the fall. And I live on a farm, and every fall, thousands of monarchs land in the same tree. Mm-hmm. Every fall. They come in like tourists of a night, stay and leave like tourists in the morning. Well, kind of unusual. They generally congregate on the same branches. And that's all I had to say. It was just a comment on that, on the monarch butterfly. That commentary, wherever I saw it, whether WILN or something, was fabulous. That's all I had to say. Thank you.
All right.
Yeah,
Thank you.
It is one of, I hate to sound trite here, nature's wonders how these butterflies migrate every fall from wherever they are breeding in the throughout the eastern U.S. and end up in the same mountaintop in Mexico to overwinter. And there are unusual microclimatic conditions that make that just the right safe place. And all along their way, they, as the caller indicated, there are way stations. There are places where traditionally every year these monarchs will congregate. There, Illini Grove, we had monarchs overwintering a couple of years. I don't know, maybe the neighborhood changed. There goes the neighborhood. But 10 to 20,000 monarchs would just rest there for a night. It's an absolutely spectacular sight. Mm. And along those lines, if I can put in a plug for our department, actually, and with a lot of help from a lot of people in town, is going about to open a pollinatarium, a new Discovery Science Center devoted to pollinators and the plants they pollinate. And we have an exhibit. Well, I mentioned this because we have an exhibit on the monarchs and the monarch migration with some phenomenal photographs. And we have exhibits on every group of pollinators, not just insects, but bats and hummingbirds and as well. And more on that later, but we should be opening next month. So and it's family friendly. There are all kinds of interactive exhibits. We have a history of beekeeping. Anyway, it'll be, I think, a nice place for people to learn more about bees and monarchs and other pollinators.
Yeah. Well, you know, actually, I was thinking about asking you about migration in insects, because I was thinking that probably most insects, while they do move, that generally they hang where they are and they overwinter where they are. And aside from butterflies, are there many insects that migrate?
The monarch butterfly is a little bit unusual because of the predictability of this migration. But there are quite a number of species that have, well, it depends on what you call a migration. There are many, many, many species that have rather short-term movements to go to overwintering sites, for example. A lot of ladybugs will go head for the mountains to overwinter. That's one reason the multicolored Asian lady beetle ends up in people's houses. It's looking for an overwintering site. There are dragonflies that have these spectacular migratory flights that are comparable to the monarchs, although they're not sort of aiming it at one particular destination. In some ways, the migratory locust, Schistocerca gregaria, the biblical locust plague, these are intermittent migratory movements that can cover hundreds or if not thousands of miles. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it just there are all kinds of migratory movements of insect species. But, even painted ladies sometimes. People don't really notice these migratory movements until the insects end up plastered on their windshields. It's easy to miss. But, they're quite a number. But not quite like the birds where they're, flying to traditional overwintering sites.
All right. This does bring to mind the multicolored Asian lady beetle that we now have seen more and more over the last few years, and they show up because they want to come inside when it starts getting cold outside, and then some people may have them large numbers in their house, or at least they're enough so that they're noticeable, and they're just sort of, I mean, if my experience is they're kind of a minor nuisance, it's like, you can live with them, or if you can't, you can just get your vacuum cleaner and something up. But eventually they disappear. And I find myself wondering, well, does that mean that have they gone someplace else? Are they still in my house somewhere? Or if they're gone, does that mean that they've died?
Some of them have died because it's, if you have central heating, it might be too hot and dry for them. Some of them are probably still there. They're clearly not all dying because we have them reliably year after year. And in fact, there's no black and white in the insect world. These guys were introduced as biocontrol agents for tree-dwelling aphids. They didn't do too well on that respect. But it turns out they're the major enemies in soybean fields of the recently introduced soybean aphid. So yes, they're obnoxious in your house. They smell bad. People have allergic reactions. In Ontario, they've ruined a couple of wine crops with their defensive secretions, which just completely creates an off flavor. But in soybean fields, they really knock down the numbers of the soybean aphids, which are noxious pests in and of themselves.
Uh-huh. So, again, it's this complicated web business, and you never quite know what's going to happen.
Half full, half empty, donut or hole.
You introduce something, you take something out. That's, you know, so if you're saying, gee, you know, couldn't we get rid of the fleas? Couldn't we get rid of mosquitoes? Couldn't we get rid of the ticks? Well, you never know what might happen if you do.
That's right.
We're coming down to kind of to it. Actually, someone off the air wanted to know if it was possible to get festival T-shirts and how you do that. Do
oh, absolutely. We can. I think we can take orders. I know that there's usually an order form at the festival. So if you call the department office, if you can't come to the festival, the T-shirts will be there for purchase at the festival. I think we'll also have a few back. We have 25 years. We had no T-shirts at the first festival of T-shirts. And some of the we may have some vintage ones for sale as well there. But the department phone number is 217-333-2910. And you can call if you can't come to the festival and ask about getting put on a list for a T-shirt.
All right. So once again, this weekend, Saturday, Follinger Auditorium on the U of I campus, 26th Insect Fear Film Festival. The theme is centipedes. And if you've been taking notes, no, they're not insects, but that's okay. actually, there's precedent because you have done spiders and they're not insects.
We had an all-spider festival. We had a non-insect arthropod film festival. We showed the black scorpion, among other things. Doors open at 6, related activities. And we also have our annual art contest for kids in schools around the area, all competing to create the scariest or the prettiest or the most thematically relevant.
All right. And you can also get your copy of the Orange and Blue Insect Calendar, a year of orange and blue insects celebrating 100 years of entomology at the U of I. So thank you very much.
Always a pleasure. Thank
May Barenbaum, she's head of the Department of Entomology. And if you're interested in reading some books about insects, you could look for some of her books, including 99 Gnats, Nits and Nibblers, 99 More Maggots, Mites and Munchers, Bugs in the System, Buzzwords, Scientist Muses on Sex, Bugs, and Rock and Roll.
And look in August for a new one.
Oh, okay. Available at bookstores everywhere. Mm-hmm. And later in the spring, I'm sure May will come back and we'll talk some more. Thanks. Thanks
Thank
very much.
You.